Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Special Counsel Robert Mueller referring evidence to the FBI that pro-Trump political operatives are offering to pay women to make false claims against Mueller, accusing him of sexually harassing women in an effort to discredit the Mueller probe. One of these women, Jennifer Taub, who recently received an email trying to enlist her in smearing Mueller, joins us. A professor of law at Vermont Law School, she forwarded the email to the special counsel's office, who then contacted the FBI. And we will discuss the content of the email and the offer of money from a Simon Frick, a researcher at a firm called Surefire Intelligence. Although Jennifer has never met or spoken to Mueller, the pro-Trump troll wrote, quote, "It's my understanding you may have had some past encounters with Robert Mueller, and he wanted her to talk about it in a phone call, quote, for which I would compensate you at whatever rate you see fit inside reason would be a good place to start, and a beginning rate to talk with you about all encounters you've had with Special Counsel Mueller." And on another subject, with widespread condemnation and dismissal of Trump's call to end birthright citizenship, which many see as a last-minute election ploy to rile up his base, we will discuss Jennifer Taub's op-ed at CNN, "Trump's Thumbing His Nose at the Law on Citizenship." Then, with the return to Saudi Arabia from exile in London of the younger brother of King Salman, Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, we will examine the possibility that there may be efforts underway to check the reckless and murderous abuse of power being exercised by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, MBS. Gregory Gause, Chair and Professor of International Relations at Texas A&M University and author of Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence, joins us to discuss the other signal that limitations may be imposed on MBS's power, with the announcement today by Secretary of State Pompeo and Defense Secretary Mattis that the U.S. wants a halt to the disastrous Saudi war in Yemen. Then finally, we will speak with Chuck Collins, who directs the program on inequality and co-edits inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies, about his new study at inequality.org, Billionaire Bonanza 2018, The Role of Dynastic Wealth, and his article at The Guardian, "The Wealth of America's Three Richest Families Grew by 6,000% since 1982. With former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker warning, quote, "We are developing into a plutocracy," we will discuss how since 1982, the Walton, Mars, and Koch families have seen their wealth increase by 6,000%, while the median household wealth went down 3% over the same period. And joining us now is Jennifer Taub, who is a professor at the Vermont Law School, who was previously Associate General Counsel for Fidelity Investments and Assistant Vice President for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. And her latest book is Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business. And she has an op-ed at CNN, "Trump's Thumbing His Nose at the Law on Citizenship." Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Taub.
It's my pleasure to be here, Ian.
So, Jennifer, you were contacted a while back, I think earlier this month, by what appears to be an effort on the part of some, I don't know whether how to describe them, trolls, I guess is the term that's used today, people who want to discredit Robert Mueller, presumably at the behest of Donald Trump. So walk us through what happened.
So last Monday, that was October 22nd, I got a somewhat creepy email from someone claiming to work for an organization called Surefire Intelligence. And this person whose name claimed to be someone named, I think it was Simon Frick, said, greeted me, said, "Dear Professor, I understand you've had encounters with Robert Mueller." I got through that first sentence and I thought, this is weird. I've never met Special Counsel Robert Mueller. I've never spoken with him. And so I almost didn't, continue reading. I almost just emailed back saying, "Dear Simon, you're mistaken. I've never met him. Have a nice day." But out of curiosity, I continued reading, and it turns out this person wanted me to speak with him on the telephone and share with him the nature of my encounters, and he was offering to pay me whatever price I saw fit within reason, or I think as it was worded, inside reason, which struck me as a funny form of phrasing, and I didn't know if the person was from overseas or what, whatever. And then the next part of the email said that he was working as part of an effort to investigate Robert Mueller's past, and went on to say that in addition to paying for me to speak to him, he would also pay if I could refer the names of others. And then the email concluded, you know, saying something like, I hope you would understand, you know, keep this discreet. And I kind of thought to myself, well, this is really disturbing. At the time, I had no idea. I didn't think why I was contacted. The only thing I could think of is that maybe somebody else had gotten an email like this and gave them my name because I've spoken before publicly about the Mueller investigation. And I thought maybe someone thinks I used to be a federal prosecutor, and I never was. So I didn't understand why I'd been targeted. It also occurred to me, given that I'm so public, you know, so vocal about my concerns about the president's lawlessness and so on, that maybe someone was trying to, perhaps they were trying to set me up in some way to see whether I would take money to participate in some illegal conspiracy. So I was concerned about it, and I immediately, after reading the whole email, went online, tried to find a contact phone number for the special counsel's office, and all I could find was an email address, so I forwarded it on to the special counsel's office saying, you know, I don't plan to respond to this, but I thought that you should be aware that someone's sending out emails like this in a rather random fashion. And I sent that on Monday. And then after I sent it, I was still upset about it and concerned. And I shared that email with two friends of mine, one, Jed Sugarman, who is a law professor at Fordham, and also Mimi Rocha, who's a former federal prosecutor, and we've become friendly because we all follow the Mueller investigation fairly closely. And they both remarked that this was highly suspicious. And then we didn't really communicate again until the story broke on Monday, until the special prosecutor's spokesperson announced, I'm sure you heard this yesterday, it wasn't Monday, it was Tuesday, yesterday, announced that indeed, they had referred some kind of scam or some kind of operation to the FBI to investigate, and that it involved someone trying to pay women to say, you know, make up stories about Robert Mueller having perhaps sexually harassed them. So when I learned of this, my friends, I think it was Jed who alerted me to a story Natasha Bertrand had published in The Atlantic. He also connected me with her, and I spoke with her, because I had no connection to her, and then she included the account of my email in her story. And so I just wanted to further, I know I'm talking quite a bit, Ian, so initially I just thought this was an effort just to kind of have a wide net and target Mueller or try to approach me. But then when I found out it was about perhaps sexual harassment, I began to think that maybe somebody had read an op-ed I wrote a few weeks ago on the CNN platform about the Kavanaugh hearings and about sexual assault. So maybe someone did a quick look and thought I'd be a good person to approach. It's all very curious to me still at this point.
And there is, of course, this other woman who identifies herself as Lorraine Parsons, who's been contacting several journalists. So there appears to be some kind of campaign underway. And what did you learn about Surefire Intelligence and this person that supposedly associated with them, this GOP activist named Jack Berkman?
I have perhaps read some of the same news stories and Twitter feeds as you have. And according to what I've read, journalists seem to believe that somebody named Jacob Wall is Surefire Intelligence, and that perhaps this other person that you mentioned, Jack Berkman, may have hired him. What I've read is that Berkman is planning some kind of press conference at a Holiday Inn tomorrow. That would be November 1st. and that Berkman's planning some kind of press conference at this Holiday Inn to, I don't know, introduce to the press women he says have complaints about Mueller. So that's all, you know, what I've also read about Berkman is I believe he's allegedly the person, one of the people who was promoting this really terrible fake news story about the death of Seth Rich. So these are, I'm sorry to use the word fake news, I should say some unfounded conspiracy about the sad death of Seth Rich. And, you know, these characters have what appear to be, what I've read, fairly shady reputations, but I have no idea if they were behind this email. I only can read the email I have, and I'm watching others investigate the story.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Taub, who's a professor at the Vermont Law School, who's previously Associate General Counsel for Fidelity Investments and Assistant Vice President for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. She is the author of Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business, and she has an op-ed at CNN, Trump's Thumbing His Nose at the Law on Citizenship. But back to the letter that you received recently, where somebody is trying to enlist you to smear the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Who signed the letter?
So this email, it was an email never printed out.
Right.
And the signatory to it was someone named Simon Frick, who may not actually be a real person.
Mm-hmm.
That may just be a pseudonym.
I see. So, and there's also somebody in the panel that's been contacting people with a British accent. Has that person been identified? I mean, my assumption would be, Jennifer, that Robert Mueller operates with a team of FBI agents, does he not? So when you forwarded the email to them, they wouldn't have had to have necessarily turned it over to the FBI. They've got FBI agents right there in the office, don't they?
I don't know if anyone read my email or if it was one of the ones that they used to give to the FBI. And I also don't, but they pressed the spokesperson did say they contacted the FBI. What I don't know is whether they relied on the same FBI agents they might rely on their investigation or others. So I don't really know that mechanism.
Right. Well, they've let's assume that the FBI agents working for Mueller have their hands full. So they're pretty busy, I think. Don't you think something's going to be coming out relatively soon after the elections? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think many of us expect, see this sort of as a quiet period these weeks leading up to the election. And a lot of us are expecting that there'll be more either, informations or indictments. And associated, if there are information associated, please. And, I did not expect any news about the Mueller investigation until after next week's midterm. And I have to tell you, I didn't expect any news, but I certainly didn't expect me to be the news about it.
Right.
But there was a little bit, I don't know if you saw this, yesterday there was some news that broke that apparently Steve Bannon, who used to work worked both on the Trump campaign and, as you know, in the Trump White House, was apparently interviewed yet another time by the special counsel's office, apparently in connection with Roger Stone. So, I would expect some action against Roger Stone soon after next week.
And what did you make of the Politico article that's out now suggesting that Mueller has actually been negotiating for some time on some kind of subpoena for President Trump to appear before the grand jury?
I hope so. I just don't know. What we do know is that we've seen the White House say this, that it's been a very, very long time. That they somehow are negotiating even a voluntary meeting where the president would simply sit down with a special prosecutor's attorneys without going to the grand jury. And in terms of a subpoena, I'm not sure whether that would be a subpoena for documents or an actual subpoena to appear. It's really hard to know, you know, what the truth is there, because, as you know, the special prosecutor's office rarely communicates with the press. And that's why this communication yesterday was so startling or surprising to journalists.
So let's talk a little bit about your article, Jennifer Taubat, CNN Trump's Thumbing His Nose at the Law on Citizenship. Obviously, you have become the news yourself, and I imagine it's somewhat distracting from what you had written about. But clearly, this announcement yesterday in an interview with Axios, where President Trump says that he thinks that he has the executive authority to end birthright citizenship. And a lot of people think it was basically a part of this. Lately, he's been throwing everything at the wall to see what would stick, demonizing the caravan, talking about getting a middle-class tax cut done literally before the elections, even though the Congress is in recess, all kinds of promises and also fear-mongering as well. How do you see this latest announcement? Because already Paul Ryan came out and said it's not going to happen. There's no way that he can unilaterally deal with this. Most scholars say that this is a absolute non-starter because of the 14th Amendment. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, look, as a legal matter, he absolutely does not have the right to end birthright citizenship by executive order. And just to be clear, birthright citizenship is something guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. That was 150 years ago. And shortly thereafter, there was a Supreme Court case making it very clear that any baby born in the United States, regardless of whether their parents are citizens here or not, that baby is a U.S. citizen. So, you know, I don't know, you know, and the approach I took to this op-ed is, you know, for most people, the birth of a new child is a wonderful moment of our of a family and society's renewal, and we feel joyful about the prospects. Most people feel joyful about others' families, including immigrants' families. And what we know based on the data is whatever additional cost to educate children of first generation immigrants, it turns out they contribute so much more later to the society and the economy. So the fact that he is making a statement about something he has no legal ability to do, the fact that he is attacking people who want to come to this country is not about what he can do legally, but he is playing to his dwindling base. And Ian, I have to tell you, this is incredibly shameful for him to have made this proposal on yesterday morning, on Tuesday, just days after 11 people were killed by an anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic, gun-wielding, angry person who is, you know, who is shares, it appears, some of the same, you know, hatred of immigrants that the president himself does. This is not the time to continue to, you know, to create fear and anger and stir it up among, again, it's his dwindling base right before the election. I find it shameful, I was astonished that he was focused on that yesterday morning. And so, indeed, I spent most of my day yesterday when I wasn't teaching working on that op-ed. And I'm, you know, like others in the legal profession and just other members of the human race, we find this astonishing and very distressing that he would try this tactic right now.
Well, Jennifer Taubat, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Ian. Have a nice evening.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Taubat, who's a professor at the Vermont Law School, who was previously Associate General Counsel for Fidelity Investments and Assistant Vice President for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. And her latest book is Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business. And she has an op-ed at CNN, Trump's Thumbing His Nose at the Law on Citizenship. We're going to take a brief station break and back, examining the possibility that there may be efforts underway to check the reckless and murderous abuse of power being exercised by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, MBS.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walk,
welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gregory Gores, who's Chair and Professor of International Affairs at Texas A&M University and the author of three books, The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf Countries, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. And previously, he was a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Gores.
Thank you.
And what do you make of the return of Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, the youngest brother of the current King Salman? He is the last, I guess, of the Sadari Seven, named after the favorite wife of King Abdulaziz. And it seems there's a couple of things happening here. We know about, of course, the paralysis caused by the scandal in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, the murder of Khashoggi, and the extent to which Erdogan is sort of, I don't know what he's angling for, but he's drawing that out. And a couple of important things have happened. One is the return of this prince who didn't want to go back. He was afraid to go back, apparently. But also the announcement today by Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Pompeo that they are urging the Saudis to stop bombing in Yemen. Clearly, these seem related, at least in my mind. So let's begin there. Is there something going on, do you think, Gregory?
Well, something's up. There's no question about it. The affairs of the Saudi ruling family are so opaque that the best we can do is speculate. But I think that the one concrete fact we have is that a senior prince who was passed over, not so much by King Salman and Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, but he had lost his position earlier under King Abdullah. He's returning. He's one of the few members of the king's generation with significant political experience who's left alive. And so he has become something of a focus for people who are looking for an alternative to the crown prince. Now, I don't think that he has the policy chops to actually be a serious alternative to the crown prince, but he could become a factor in family politics in Riyadh in an effort to kind of clip the wings of the crown prince, maybe bring some more senior princes who have been sidelined by the king and the crown prince into the decision-making process. That's a possibility. The other thing that one hears kind of bandied about and rumored is that he's being called back as part of an effort to show solidarity. I put less stock in that. He wouldn't have to come back to do that. And he's not so central to the politics of the family that he would be necessary simply for a show of solidarity, I think. But it is opaque, so we're going to have to see what develops. I mean, there's some reports that he's come back under kind of implicit or explicit protection from Britain and the United States, guarantees that his safety will be protected. And that would indicate, if that's true, and again, that's just rumor, if that's true, that would indicate an international effort to try to affect the deliberations within the ruling family right now. So the only thing we know is that something is up. I think the Yemen thing was, in one sense, long overdue. But I do think that this is a response on the U.S. side to what is a mounting sense in Congress that there has to be some reassessment of maybe not the entire range of the U.S.-Saudi relationship, but at a minimum of some elements of it that are associated with Mohammed bin Salman. And the Yemen war is what, even before the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, had mobilized a fair amount of opposition in the U.S. Congress.
Well, the fact that if indeed it's true that U.K. and the U.S. have asked for guarantees or want to guarantee the safety of Prince Ahmed, the younger brother of King Salman, so that he could return from exile in London, where apparently he was afraid of MBS, mm-hmm. the very fact that such guarantees are necessary is hard to reconcile with the idea that this is our ally and this is the person talking about MBS that was hailed as the great reformer. I mean, the scales are off, aren't they, after the Khashoggi murder? And in general, how can anybody not see MBS as at the very least being reckless, if not, you know, quite murderous?
Well, I mean, I think that you'd have to say he's murderous. I think that anyone who believed that Mohammed bin Salman was a political reformer was naive. He gave absolutely no indication of that and was pretty straightforward about the fact that there wasn't going to be political reform in Saudi Arabia. I think a lot of people, both in the West and frankly in Saudi Arabia, were quite supportive of the social reforms on gender issues, on public entertainments, on rolling back some of the power of the religious establishment to define what's acceptable public behavior in Saudi Arabia. There was quite a bit of support for that. And in many ways, I think that even with the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, in the long term, what people will remember Mohammed bin Salman for is it's going to be the Khashoggi murder, but will also be that he was the one who finally cut the Gordian knot of Saudi politics and gave women the right to drive. The recklessness issue, I think, is absolutely clear, both in domestic politics and foreign policy. On the domestic politics side, he was the Crown Prince is the one who arrested and interned almost over 300 members of the elite of the business and political elite of the kingdom in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel back in November. Partially to shake them down for money and partially as an assertion of political power. But I think it's on the foreign policy side that the recklessness is even more apparent. Whether it was the de facto kidnapping of the Lebanese prime minister and forcing him to resign in an address from Riyadh that didn't lead to any political change in Lebanon, the overreaction to the criticism from Canada this summer of Saudi human rights issues that led to, in effect, practically a break of relations with Canada. The boycott of Qatar, which hasn't achieved any of its goals, and of course the Yemen war, would be indications that that the Crown Prince isn't properly calculating the second and third order consequences of his foreign policy actions. And then the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey, in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, is just another indication of that.
And again, I'm speaking with Gregory Gores, who's Chair and Professor of International Affairs at Texas A&M University and the author of three books, International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Previously was a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. So you've given us an absolute list of, you know, what would be deal breakers in terms of leadership, and yet he's in power still, or he's about to become the king. At least that's the assumption, that MBS will ascend to the throne because his father apparently has some form of dementia. So what offsets that? I mean, the fact that he's popular, again, I'm sure it's pretty opaque trying to measure these things in Saudi Arabia, since there's it's an absolute monarchy and there's no freedom to do anything. But that's what you hear anecdotally, that the young people like him. So how do you reconcile those two? An outrageous foreign policy record, which would indicate to everybody in the neighborhood that, you know, you're going to be in for a rocky road with this guy in charge for the next several decades. That should be enough to, you know, get people's attention. But on the other hand, it seems that he has, you know, not just the brute power of having jailed everybody, taken over all the militaries and the intelligence services and jailed all of his rivals, shook them down for money, etc. So what's your explanation, Gregory Gores, for that disconnect between reckless foreign policy and domestic popularity?
I think that the foreign policy consequences haven't hit home for the average person in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are conducting an air war in Yemen. They haven't committed a whole lot of troops, and while they've had some casualties, it's not that many. So the Yemen war doesn't hit home for the average Saudi. And these other foreign policy issues, as important as they are, again, they don't affect people's daily lives. And so I think that there's and the news management, of course, in Saudi Arabia, all of this stuff is presented in the most favorable light, the Yemen war as a necessary fight against Iranian expansionism, the investigation of the Khashoggi murder as some kind of biased thing against Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, there's information management as well as the fact that the foreign policy miscues and missteps haven't really affected the daily lives of Saudis. But I think it has raised a number of questions about the Crown Prince's judgment, not only in the United States, but also in other capitals around the world and among elites in Saudi Arabia. And the Khashoggi murder is the occasion for those doubts to kind of come to the surface. And we're seeing, I think, pressure, both internal and external, for some curbing of the Crown Prince's unilateral powers. For decades, Saudi policy, high policy, was made by consensus among senior princes. And what King Salman and the Crown Prince have done is basically cut out that system and solidify power in the hands of these two people, the king on more general issues and big-ticket items, and Mohammed bin Salman on day-to-day. And I think this is speculation on my part, but my guess is that there is pressure, both from within the family and from external players, to see some senior people in the ruling family reinstalled in positions of authority to put some guardrails around the Crown Prince. I think I think it would be impossible to get the Crown Prince removed from his office. I think given the fact that he does control the military and indirectly the National Guard and the intelligence services, I think it would be extremely risky for anyone in Saudi Arabia to try to make that push. But the idea that you might have senior members of the family take important positions like foreign minister and act as a restraint on the Crown Prince is something that we might see happen.
Well, what about pressure from President Trump? We know that recently he made the most extraordinary statements about Saudi Arabia, where he said the killing of Khashoggi was a bad concept. He almost implied that he would have done it better. He said, you know, it was a terrible cover-up. He didn't say it was a terrible thing. He just said it was a terrible cover-up. He was criticizing their methodology as opposed to their human rights abuse. And we know that apparently both he and Jared and company really wanted the Crown Prince. They lobbied for him over the real Crown Prince, because he was Deputy Crown Prince originally, MBS, over Mohammed bin Nayef, who's apparently very popular in Washington, particularly so with the foreign policy establishment. Mohammed bin Nayef is apparently under house arrest and had his fortune confiscated. So can they bring him back, or do you think Trump has recognized maybe he chose the wrong horse?
So I doubt that the president has come to that realization. I do think that it was a real mistake for the Trump administration to be as public as they were in their backing of Mohammed bin Salman. I don't think the United States should take, you know, to be publicly seen to be trying to play within the politics of the al-Saud family. I think that that kind of thing usually backfires, and I think we're seeing that now. It seems to me that you're not going to go to the Trump administration or to the president himself for a sophisticated analysis of the foreign policy consequences of what's going on in Saudi Arabia. So I think that the administration is backpedaling a bit. I think that the Yemen, the announcements by Secretary Pompeo and Secretary Mattis about Yemen are an effort by the, or a realization by the administration that they have some mending to do on the domestic side if they want to maintain the relationship with Saudi Arabia. So I think that was a mistake for them to be as open as they were in kind of anointing Mohammed bin Salman as America's man.
But do you think, just in closing, Gregory Gorge, you think people like Senator Lindsey Graham, who basically said, you know, I went to the mat for you guys in the White House, and look where you got us. You know, this guy's the wrecking ball. He's got to go. What kind of influence does the House and Senate, in terms of foreign relations, they've actually got the purse strings. Would they be enough to get Trump and his son-in-law Jared to rethink this relationship?
I don't think that you're going to see a rethink of the overall relationship, but I think on Yemen, the Congress is going to have quite a bit of push. And I think that that's what Pompeo and Mattis are anticipating, the fact that there'll be strong congressional majorities, maybe even veto-proof congressional majorities, to cut off American cooperation with Saudi Arabia over the campaign in Yemen.
Well, Gregory Gorse, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Certainly.
And again, I've been speaking with Gregory Gorse, who's Chair and Professor of International Affairs at Texas A&M University and the author of three books, The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. And previously, he was a Fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how, since 1982, the Walton, Mars, and Koch families have seen their wealth increase by 6,000%, while the median household wealth went down 3% over the same period. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and co-edits inequality.org. He's the author of Born on Third Base, a 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, and Is Inequality in America Irreversible? And he is the co-author of the new report at inequality.org, Billionaire Bonanza 2018, The Role of Dynastic Wealth. And his latest article at The Guardian is The Wealth of America's Three Richest Families Grew by 6,000% since 1982. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Chuck. And I must say, your piece at The Guardian, it's just shocking in terms of the extraordinary growth in wealth of the three richest families in the United States, the Waltons of Walmart, the Mars Candy family, and the Koch brothers. These three families own a combined fortune of $348.7 billion, which is 4 million times the median wealth of a U.S. family. And since 1982, these three families have seen their wealth increase nearly 6,000%. Meanwhile, the median household wealth went down by 3% over the same period. And in terms of the Waltons, their dynastic wealth grew from $690 million in 1982 to $169.7 billion in 2018, a mind-numbing increase of more than 9,000%. So this is enough, Chuck, to make you want to man the barricades and take out the pitchforks, you know?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we tend to focus on the wealth of the very top, you know, the sort of Jeff Bezos and the Warren Buffett and Bill Gates story, which is important. But what we're looking at here is how families not just preserve their wealth over generations, but actually sort of expand it. And, you know, it's these wealth dynasties are kind of a symptom that something's broken, that the whole idea of a sort of democratic, self-governing society is people grow wealth, but as the old adage says, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. So the idea is that wealth left to its own disperses over time. It gets taxed, it gets given to charity, and it does get passed on to, you know, dozens of grandchildren. And so the wealth disperses. In this case, we're looking at second, third, and fourth generation families that are amassing more and more wealth, and that is troublesome.
So, unfortunately, it would seem that there's too much attention paid to the wealthiest among the wealthiest, particularly Bezos and Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and also Bloomberg, George Soros, and Tom Steyer. All of them are active in charity. Many of them, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, are giving away almost all of their money to charity. And, of course, we know how much attention George Soros gets, as though he's the eminence grie of left-wing politics in this country, in spite of the fact that, just to give you an idea of how little influence Soros has, he was furiously lobbying Barack Obama when he first came into office not to buy into the Geithner Republican Wall Street solution at the top. And he had an alternative plan, and of course Obama did not listen to him and instead listened to the Republican Secretary of the Treasury instead. So that's just a way to illustrate this absurd idea that these guys are all pulling the strings. But the truth of the matter is, from what I can get from your article and also this new study by Benjamin Page, Jason Seawright, and Matthew Lacombe out of Northwestern University, is that the people that you mentioned in your article, the three families, the Mars, the Kochs, and the Waltons, they're the ones that are operating a stealth program to really change the laws to their benefit. And yet they don't get the same kind of attention that the other more humane and generous billionaires get.
That's right. They have somehow figured out how to fly below the radar. But I think what we know is they are very active in public policy. They're very active in lobbying for tax policies like eliminating the estate tax, the inheritance tax. And they probably, well, we know they're aggressive users of wealth hiding techniques, or what I would call dynasty protection measures. You know, they're hiring, you know, armies of lawyers, tax accountants, wealth managers. They have family offices that are devoted to sort of figuring out ways to work the loopholes, you know, lobby to create more loopholes and pass wealth on. And this is the wealth that we know about. I think there's vast trillions of dollars of hidden wealth that is moving around and that isn't even being measured for the purposes of taxation. So these are families that are, let's say, they're arresting the natural process of wealth dispersion, and they're figuring out how to build dynasties that will probably be here, you know, three more generations forward. We're still going to be hearing about Marses and Waltons and Kochs because they're going to continue to have a huge amount of power and wealth.
But we hear about the Fords, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, mostly in terms of their foundations that do remarkable work, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Carnegie Foundations and the Endowment for Peace, etc. These big families like the Kochs, the Waltons, and the Mars family.
The Marses.
Yeah, sorry. The
Maybe it's because of it's Halloween and you're thinking of all those Mars candy bars.
The Mars family, they're not going to be remembered for anything but greed and the accumulation of wealth. They're not. There's no incentive anymore for them to create these kind of foundations that live on to do charitable work like Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie.
No, you know, and this is a really big, important point coming out of the first Gilded Age a century ago, is people were very worried about, do these concentrations of wealth and power, will this upset our fragile, self-governing democracy? And, you know, people put in place the inheritance tax and the progressive income tax. And that really did have the effect of slowing the concentration of wealth and encouraging people to give to charity. And then you had people like Andrew Carnegie who said, you know, I'm not going to pass on wealth to my children. I'd rather pass on a curse. You know, he gave, you know, an incredible amount of almost all of his wealth to knowledge institutions, building libraries and research institutions. So you don't hear, there are no members of the Carnegie family on the Forbes 400 list, you know, three generations later, nor Ford, the Ford family. The Ford family, you know, even though they're wealthy at the time, there's no, you know, dynastic billion-dollar fortunes with the name Ford on them. So they are more typical of the U.S. experience of wealth dispersing. And it's true, that, I mean, the Walton family does have a large family foundation. They also have so much money that is not moving into charity. And you have to wonder, why are they sitting on, you know, $160 billion of wealth? What are they, what's the plan here?
Well, they also essentially invest in reactionary charity projects, if indeed I can use the word charity, like charter schools.
Yes.
Which
yeah,
seems
John
to be...
Walton is a right. major funder of charter school and privatization of education. So
right.
They're not a benign force. They're a negative force.
Right. So as you point out in your article at The Guardian, Chuck, in the early 2000s, the Mars, the Waltons, and the Gallo families out here in California of Gallo Wine, they actively lobbied to abolish the federal estate tax, which, of course, is largely paid by multimillionaires and billionaires. So that's when that whole idea, they use these think tanks to gin up this idea that all these family farms were going broke because of the estate tax. Is that their work?
Exactly. And I was there. It was really 20 years ago that we started to see these advertisements and this campaign kind of emerging out of nowhere to abolish the death tax. And huge amounts of resources were going into this, and a lot of it was around creating this kind of false misinformation campaign that the estate tax, the death tax, was something that everyone would have to pay, as opposed to the reality, which was only paid by multimillionaires and billionaires. And they were incredibly effective. And when we started to dig into, like, well, who's the money behind this? It were these dynastic wealthy families. It wasn't first-generation entrepreneurs. It was people who were, like, second- and third-generation wealthy people like the Gallo Wine family. The Waltons were there. The Mars family was there. Those families were investing in public policy. As we said, they were willing to spend millions to save themselves billions in future taxes.
But at the end of the day, they buy very conservative, usually Republican, congressmen and senators, do they not, to enact these laws?
They use their philanthropic resources. As Jane Mayer pointed out in Dark Money, they figure out how to weaponize philanthropy to advance a very narrow agenda, and they give their money to PACs and political campaigns, and they overall have an enormous influence on democratic institutions. So they were able to almost abolish the estate tax. It was hanging by a thread, and the fact that it's still there, it's been considerably weakened as a tax. So the amount of money it raises, the impact it has on concentrated wealth is greatly diminished.
Well, but as you point out, the casino magnate, Sheldon Adelson, who's donated more than $100 million in campaign donations in this election that's less than a week away, the midterms. He's apparently number 15 on the Forbes 400 list, and he's used a complicated trust mechanism to pass on $7.9 billion to his children while avoiding $2.8 billion in gift and estate taxes. So whatever estate tax exists in terms of a regime, it seems like these rich people like Adelson can get around it.
Yeah, and, you know, former Treasury official Gary Cohen kind of implied this. He says, why the estate tax only his quote was, only morons pay the estate tax. And what he was, you know, revealing with that was that very wealthy people have figured out how to plan around that. They create these very complicated trusts, and they figure out how to move money around. And so this is how today's billionaires are going to be tomorrow's wealth dynasties. You know, the Adelson family. Some of these families, I mean, the Adelsons figured out how to pass on almost $8 billion and avoiding almost $2.3 billion in gift and estate taxes. So they're moving money to the next generation without paying any taxes and circumventing the rules that are there. And I think we're just going to see more of that. So I think we're going to see these dynasties growing over time as opposed to dispersing.
But how do they get away with, I mean, I understand using as your fronts and feeding the propaganda of death tax to these conservative Republican candidates and officials, but then their job in turn is to pass very unpopular legislation, which is aimed at cutting popular programs like Social Security, Medicare, etc. So that's the amazing part of it, is that these billionaire families are able to advance unpopular inequality, exacerbating highly conservative economic policies. So what does that say about the rest of us? Are we simply not paying attention?
Well, I think that it is. I think most people don't fully understand these dynamics at the very, very high, you know, sort of billionaire level in society. And experience society more as, oh, government can't get anything done that really matters to me. And it's not just passing conservative legislation, it's really blocking anything else. So even though the wider public would like to see the minimum wage higher, they believe that the tax code should be considerably fairer and that the wealthy should pay more. They believe we should have, you know, low tuition or free tuition at higher education institutions, you know, paid for by a progressive tax. Even though people want those things, they're essentially blocked by a political system dominated by wealth. And so I think people are feeling cynical, feeling powerless, but at the same time, we should remind ourselves, there's overwhelming popular support for the kinds of things that would reduce these inequalities. And it's really a matter of electing people who are campaigning on those kind of programs, supporting campaigns. You know, there was an effort in California to bring back California's state estate tax and link the money to a college for all. It didn't get the necessary number of signatures to go on the ballot, but that campaign, that movement is still there. And I think we'll see it again. So those are the kind of things that I think could turn this around and could lead to the reversal of these inequalities.
Well, you mentioned Gary Cohen, who said that anybody who pays an estate taxes is a moron. The last thing he got through was that huge tax cuts for the super rich, this so-called middle-class tax cut that the Republicans passed and that Donald Trump claimed was for the middle class. Now, of course, he's come out with a new one saying we have a new tax cut for the middle class, almost a de facto recognition of the fraud of the original tax cut that they passed a little while back. And we now know how catastrophic that's going to be. Already Janet Yellen, the former head of the Fed, is saying deficits are unsustainable. We will have trillion-dollar deficits now for at least the next 4 years because of this giveaway to the super rich under Trump. And guess what they're doing already? Mitch McConnell is saying we're going to have to cut Social Security. So that's their strategy. You give enormous tax cuts to the super wealthy who don't need it. That balloons the deficits because you're not getting the revenues that you normally should be getting. And then that gives you an excuse to cut the so-called entitlement programs for the middle class and the poor. I mean, again, this is just so reactionary and so punitive and so outrageous. This is something you'd expect in the Middle Ages under a feudal system.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, in a way, the so-called starve the beast strategy, we're seeing it laid out here. And you're going to have, oh, well, government spending is rising. Well, actually, government spending hasn't been rising. It hasn't been rising anywhere near as much as deficits caused by tax cuts. But that's going to be the story we hear. What's fascinating is just how few people are falling for it. People overwhelmingly, I mean, most people support tax cuts generally. It's just sort of a reflexive thing. It's like, sure, a tax cut, that sounds great. People didn't support these Trump tax cuts back at a year ago. They understood that they were mostly going to a couple, you know, hundred global corporations and the very rich. They're not good talking points on the campaign trail. They've decided to stop talking about the tax cuts because most people are like, hey, those were for the rich. So they're back to the anti-immigration, you know, talking points. And this, I don't think people are going to fall for the, you know, oh, we need to now cut entitlements because our deficits are so big. There is going to be growing pressure to reverse the Trump tax cuts. That should be the demand, that they're a disastrous mistake, and they should be reversed. And I think there's mounting pressure and awareness that that's what we have to do.
Well, we should call them the Trump and Gary Cohn tax cuts, because Trump, I don't think, knows what he's doing. He doesn't care. He's a total sociopath and a narcissist. But Gary Cohn came across as the reasonable one. Remember, he was the guy that was upset over Trump's coddling the Nazis at Charlottesville. So just in closing, what makes those kind of people tick? We know Trump's a disaster, but Cohn was basically considered one of the adults in the room.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have a theory of how the economy's going to grow and how tax cuts are part of that. And there's also just plain old donor payback. I mean, you know, the Sheldon Adelsons of the world said, I'm never going to give any money to Republicans again if you can't get this tax cut passed, and mm-hmm. other major donors. That is their top priority. They want to pay less taxes. They want to build these wealth dynasties. They want to pass on unlimited inheritances to their children and grandchildren. They want the power that goes along with that, and they're using their power. Mm-hmm. And that tax cut from a year ago was really the payback. And but it's fundamentally anti-democratic. It fundamentally undermines, you know, our voices, everybody else's voices in the economy. And it's time to obviously push back.
Right. And every rich kid that I've ever met in my life, Chuck, has been screwed up. So these are the ones that are inheriting the earth, right? Go figure.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Chuck Collins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and co-edits inequality.org. He's the author of Born on Third Base, a 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, and Is Inequality in America Irreversible? And he is the co-author of a new report at inequality.org, Billionaire Bonanza 2018, The Role of Dynastic Wealth. And his latest article at The Guardian is The Wealth of America's Three Richest Families Grew by 6,000% since 1982. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.